Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jesus, Savior, pilot me over last tempestuous sea.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Carol Boyer. With more than 30 years in the academic, federal, private, and nonprofit sectors, and more than 28 years of that experience in the disability field, Carol Boyer brings an unparalleled scope of service to her colleagues and networks. At the Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment Policy since 2006, she currently is a lead policy advisor on the Aging and Disability Initiative, heads up her agency's Workplace Flexibility Initiative with DOL's Women's Bureau, and also chairs the Women and Trauma Federal Partners Committee. Welcome to the program, Carol.
Okay, thank you very much, Natasha.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I'd like to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself a little bit more than your bio would. How did you come to be in the position that you currently find yourself in? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a native Washingtonian, so I've pretty much lived in the D.C. area most of my life, except for a small period of time in Vicksburg, Mississippi, when my husband was stationed there. And I jumped into the disability field by accident, and it was because of my disability that I even jumped into this field, because I am a polio survivor. I contracted polio when I was 3 years old, and I was a March of Dimes Washington, D.C. poster child when I was younger. Got to meet the then Vice President Nixon and Alice Roosevelt Longworth and many other folks, because they had me come out and help raise funds for the March of Dimes, because at that time, March of Dimes was committed to polio and not to birth defects at that time, and then it changed. So I happened, and this is my story, it's absolutely true, I happened to be watching the news one night about in the mid-80s, and they had a dinner at the White House for all these previous March of Dimes poster kids who are now adults, and it was during the Reagan era, and I saw that, and I said, darn, I didn't get invited to that dinner. And I called the March of Dimes local office and talked to their PR person, and we became friends, and I found out this was for national March of Dimes persons, but had she known I existed, I would have been invited to that dinner, because I was here in D.C. as a D.C. March of Dimes representative. And we made very good friendship, because she also was we call ourselves post-polio survivors, and we have been friends ever since. And then she introduced me to someone else who was a post-polio person, just a little bit slightly older than us. And this person was working in the federal government at the time for the U.S. Access Board. It had a longer name at the time back in the mid-80s. And I was interested in moving forward. I was a stay-at-home mom and working part-time as a university instructor at the University of Maryland and doing various editing jobs. And I mentioned to this other person that we all went to lunch with that I was looking for something. And the next thing I knew, I was able to get a position with the U.S. Access Board, because the new hiring initiative in the federal government had just started. Around that time, it was called Schedule A Hiring Authority, whereby people with disabilities could be brought on, qualified people with disabilities, and I was qualified for the job. And that's how I started in 1985, working for the U.S. Access Board, and didn't know anything about disability employment field, the beginnings of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Wasn't even a law until a few years after I started, and I got very excited about being in this field. And adapted to all the learnings that I had with my writing background and my university teaching experience, and I just put all of that together. So you just read a little bit about my bio. I started out with the U.S. Access Board and then moved on to various other nonprofit and federal agencies working in this field, and here I am now, 2014, working still in the disability field. So almost 30 years in this field.
Wow. So the polio scare and a lot of what happened, because I know I have a great uncle who also was a polio survivor, What time frame was that happening in our country?
With one of the big epidemics, there was a huge epidemic in 1952, and I contracted polio in November of 1952, and had to stay in the hospital for 6 months for a three-year-old kid, or almost three and a half. That's a traumatic experience, being separated from your mom. They did let her stay at the hospital, you know, from time to time she was able to spend the night, but she had a little other, I had a younger brother, he was only 18 months old at the time, and she couldn't leave him with my grandmother all the time. So, she didn't stay with me the whole 6 months, but maybe the first week or so, and sometimes after I had certain surgeries. But, I do remember that. That was a weird time in my life.
So you were 3 years old at the time, you said?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. This being Mormon mental health, I often, lots of people who come onto the program are Mormons. You are not. Are you comfortable sharing with us a little bit, though, about maybe a faith background, or do you come from any type of faith background yourself?
I'm very comfortable sharing about my faith background. I was raised Roman Catholic and went to Catholic school for 12 years. I didn't go to kindergarten. My mother told me that was for kids that needed more socialization. At that time, most people didn't send their kids to kindergarten anyway. But, so my faith background is Roman Catholic.
And so as you are dealing with this kind of early childhood disease, what repercussions does this end up having for you and your family and kind of long-term? Have you had long-term repercussions from this?
Physically, I know that I've got post-polio syndrome. I didn't think I was getting any symptoms until I got into my late 50s. You start getting weaker again because your muscles have been not, you know, the muscles are atrophied and then you've overused some of them. And it was mostly in my right leg, but I got it in both legs, left and right. And so now that I'm older, I've got the pangs of being older and having arthritis issues because I know my mother had it when she was in her 50s and 60s. And between the post-polio syndrome and arthritis, the physical part of it is I'm not able to do a lot of things that I used to be able to do. And I use a scooter sometimes and I have to go far distances in the agency because it's sometimes a long walk to get from one end of the building to the other. So I'll use the scooter to save my strength. But I still can walk and all of that, but the scooter helps get me there faster. As far as other stuff growing up, you sometimes get that paternalistic feeling from people that you deal with because they want to take care of you and they sometimes don't think you can do certain things, which I always could when I was a kid. I had braces on both legs, walk with crutches when I was a kid. And I had a few surgeries. Of course, they wanted to always make you whole. That's the whole idea. If you have a disability, you've got to be whole. You've got to be, you know, you got to keep moving. So I don't walk with crutches anymore, and I don't use braces because the surgeries I had got rid of that. They were painful surgeries, but I no longer have to do that. But now that I'm getting older, as I said, and have post-polio syndrome, I can't go up on a curb very easily unless it's a really short curb, very short little 2 or 3 inches. But high curbs, I have to grab onto something, or I have to look for the curb cut.
So while we're on the polio subject, it seems to me like in this country there's a somewhat significant, I don't know, maybe small significant part of our population that is becoming uncomfortable with vaccinations. And I see this as part of the Mormon population as well, that there's a certain part of the Mormon population that is very into kind of natural and holistic practices when mm-hmm. it comes to medicine and those kinds of regards. And we're starting to hear stories of, you know, measles outbreaks or things of that nature that are maybe part of the repercussion of this type of a movement. Is there anything that you could speak to regarding this and whether or not you're seeing trends that are similar, or am I just...
Well, I do know in some faith communities, they don't, some segments of them don't believe in that, but personally, I do because I had to still get vaccinated with the Sabin sugar cubes after I could still have contracted another form of polio after I had first polio. I was not immune to getting respiratory polio. I could have gotten that as well. It does not make you immune once you have polio to not getting it again. It's not like other types of diseases. And I do know that the Rotary group has vaccinated many, many people in third world or developing countries. And there are still today a few outbreaks. I know there were a few outbreaks in the United States of polio in the 21st century. So I'm a person that I believe in vaccinations, and there's a lot of debate about that, and that's about all I would care to say about it right now.
Sure. Yeah, well, and there's nothing in our doctrine or creed that would keep us from vaccination. I think it's more of like just a certain part of the population that, you know, wants to return to maybe more holistic way, or is untrusting of chemicals or things in our system, you know, that they feel maybe lead to things like autism, which is very unfortunate because the research on that is not true. Anyway, there's some issues there that I'm concerned about.
I can tell you right now that I got measles, mumps, and rubella one after the other when I was in first grade.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the vaccine. It came out soon after that. You know, I'm old. They didn't, and I almost got kept back in first grade because I was missing. I had missed so much school. I would come back to school and get infected again with the next kid that was probably carrying it. And some people can be carriers and not actually have it. My mom went to school and got my work and kept me up to date with, you know, she worked with the teachers at my school so that I could keep up with my work, and I worked at home. So I was sort of homeschooled a lot during that period so I could move forward to second grade.
Yeah, so we kind of tend to forget sometimes some of the repercussions. I mean, we've enjoyed a long time without these things really being in our communities, and we can forget sometimes the implications if we don't continue the vaccination, correct?
Right.
Okay, so let's move towards your work at the Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment. Can you tell us a little bit about that department and what its goals are, what's mission, vision, things of that nature?
The Office of Disability Employment Policy, I believe, is still the newest agency at the Department of Labor. We started in late 2001. I started in the middle of the Office of Disability Employment Policy, which also we say the acronym is ODEP, O-D-E-P. And the mission of ODEP is to raise the status of people with disabilities, the employment status, not only from hiring, but from the recruitment side. It's the recruitment, hiring, retention, and advancement of individuals with disabilities. And that is our mission. And we work to have other organizations, other agencies adopt and implement policies and practices that move that needle forward. And we collaborate and we work on systems change with workforce systems, employment systems, and employers across the gamut.
So, for example, one of the jobs or quote-unquote callings that we have in our church, which is mainly a lay leadership, so most of the people in any given of our congregations are volunteers. One of these jobs is actually an employment specialist.
Oh, great.
So to kind of help, you know, those in a certain congregation who might be needing employment help, you know, to be a resource for them. What are some ways that employment specialists in our church could tap into resources that your department has to offer?
My best advice is to go to our website. We have a great website with hundreds of resources to help people that are employment service providers, volunteers, and those people that are seeking jobs that have disabilities, both physical and mental. And it's www.dol.gov/ODEP, O-D-E-P. And there's topical pages right on the homepage from employment supports, employers, workforce systems, women, you name it. We've got something to help everyone, and even youth. There's a youth page as well, because we have to help youth, and we have to help youth transition, especially youth with disabilities. And we even have wonderful pieces on disclosure and the ins and outs, the pros and cons of disclosing whether or not you have a disability, which is a big issue for people with disabilities and even the employers. So I suggest you just send them to our website, and if there's anything you can't find, there's a phone number that you can call us on, and we have someone here at ODEP. We have many policy advisors we have probably a couple hundred years of experience from our policy advisors here at ODEP to help anyone and everyone that may have questions that they might not be able to find on our website.
So you mentioned physical and mental disability. So can you speak a little bit of what that means? So maybe those with disabilities are pretty aware of that, but maybe those who don't have disabilities are not.
Well, the issue is that many people with both physical and mental disabilities, especially if they're hidden, some folks, hidden disabilities, what we call unseen disabilities, for instance, you wouldn't know whether a person walking down the street is a person with epilepsy. Or you wouldn't know if a person is deaf until you start talking with him or her, and they might share can you write something down on Gap where they might be able to read your lips, which only 30% of people who are deaf can actually read lips, which is people don't know. But the issue is, with a lot of people with disabilities and employers with hidden disabilities that you don't know, and especially with mental health disabilities you don't know, many people choose not to disclose whether they have a disability or not, or they may not even think they have a disability, because many people who are deaf, the deaf community is a separate culture in and of itself, and they just say we're deaf culture. And many people say, well, don't you want to, if there was a cure, would you want to have a cure? And many people who are deaf would not want to be a cure. It's like asking someone who's Irish, would you like to be changed to be, you know, an American? No, they're Irish. It's their culture. So the issue is that many employers now, federal contractors, and this is a big regulation that's out there now since the Office of Federal Contracts Compliance Office has issued regulations that employers need to have a goal of having a hiring and recruitment goal of 7% in their workforce, and they have to sort of ask to know whether people in their workforce or people that they're hiring and recruiting are people with disabilities. And so many people with disabilities choose not to disclose, even if they know they have a disability, because they feel that they're going to be stigmatized or treated differently at the workplace. And many people with disabilities that have what would be defined under the Americans with Disabilities Act as a disability don't think that they have a disability, especially people with certain mental health issues. And many mental health service providers don't sometimes think that the people that they are providing services to would be labeled as people with disabilities. And unfortunately, to get services in this country and in many other countries, you have to use labels. And that's the unfortunate thing. So we have a conundrum here, Sasha, of people that have obvious physical disabilities like myself. If you saw me sitting at a table at a conference room and we're talking and you didn't see me walk in, you would not even think I had a disability. When I get up and I start walking out of the room, you go, oh, she's limping along. Oh, she must have a disability. Mine is obvious. People that are in wheelchairs have some type of disability, and you don't know what it is, but they have something that keeps them, you know. And then there might be some people that are elderly or seniors that are using a wheelchair for mobility, but they might not say, I have a disability. You have people that are cancer survivors that might be using a wheelchair or walking with a cane or whatever, but they might not label themselves as a person with a disability. So it's a mixed area here about labels, people that have obvious disabilities, and people that have what is considered unseen disabilities. There's people with autism. It's an unseen disability. We don't know. So that's the issue here that becomes a real problem with doing statistics and how many people really have disabilities, and the statistics vary whether somebody's using the American Community Survey or the Census Bureau data, and there's possibly more than what the statistics show. If you use the definition that's in the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I'm going to try to finish up very quickly because there's different definitions of disability under Social Security Administration to get Social Security benefits. There's different definitions of disability under the VA, Veterans Affairs. For people that are veterans will sometimes say, I'm 30% disabled. And I go, what does that mean? 30% disabled under the Americans with Disabilities, that means you still have a disability. So they'll say 30% because lots of these different federal agencies have different definitions of what it means to have a disability. So it becomes very confusing and very difficult to get statistics and labels and what people can share about themselves or what employers want to ask. And this whole thing about disclosure is a big issue. And we have a lot of information on our website about that.
Well, and you mentioned stigmas, and I assume a big part of not wanting to disclose is the fear of being stigmatized. What are some common stigmas or challenges that you currently hear about from the disabled community that they're having to currently deal with?
The mental health one is, as we all know, is got a huge stigma. You know, a lot of people, if you hear that somebody's got mental illness or they were taking medication for depression, people get worried because they think of all the things that have been out there in the news. And they get worried and they get a little, people that you work with could be afraid of you. People with mental, if they hear about it through hearsay, and it shouldn't be anybody's business, but things do slip out sometimes, and that's why people with mental health issues choose not to disclose. They really feel that they're going to be treated differently, and oftentimes they are.
Right.
Not everyone with mental health issues or mental illness most of them are not people that are going to take a gun out. And people that are being treated for mental illness are, they're not going to be people that are, and most of the people that we've heard about in the news were not being treated. They were under the radar.
Right.
And that's a stigma, and people that have disclosed that or have disclosed that they're deaf or have disclosed that they're blind, you know, maybe they have just slight vision issues and they're starting to lose their vision and they don't want to disclose that to their employer because no one wants to be treated differently. But unfortunately, the way the law works, to be productive in your workplace, you do need reasonable accommodations. And we like to call them employment productivity tools. Everyone uses employment productivity tools. And many senior executives use BlackBerries. They have cars that take them places. They use a lot of productivity tools to make their jobs easier and to be more productive. And that's the same thing that people with disabilities need. They need productivity tools. And I hate to say that, but it sounds like when you're getting a reasonable accommodation is sort of a favor, and it really should be called productivity tools. And our assistant secretary even calls them that.
Hmm.
So it's a double-edged sword.
Right. What rights and kind of policies should those who are dealing with disabilities be aware of?
Well, you know, under ADA.gov, Department of Justice, where our new Secretary of Labor, Thomas Perez, came from the Department of Justice, and I used to work for the Disability Rights Section. And I would say the ADA.gov site is one of the best sites. We also have an employment and e-laws related to employment laws on our Department of Labor website as well. But to find out all the rights that you need, ADA.gov has a great thing for all the different rights that people with disabilities would have under voting rights, under housing rights, employment rights, public accommodation rights. It's a disability rights guide. And the Department of Justice can send guides out to people, and it's also online. Because there's a lot of faith-based communities that might just need, because for many older people, they don't use the Internet. So the Department of Justice can send those out, and they also have them in several different types of languages, even Cambodian, Vietnamese, Tagalog. It's very good. You know, not just Spanish and English. They have several different languages, Chinese. So for every faith-based community that has different populations that speak these languages, they can call the Department of Justice 800 number, which they can find on ADA.gov, and get those guides to distribute.
Okay.
Our tax dollars at work.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And so you're kind of leading into the segue that I wanted to go into, which obviously some suggestions you're giving us as congregations is, you know, assisting the elderly, for example, especially if they're not technologically prepared to be able to do some of this work on their own, or be aware of different languages. Because again, depending on where you are geographically, there may be, I know that when we lived in Wisconsin, there was a Hmong congregation there, and there's lots of Hispanic and Polynesian and different types of congregations really all over the United States. And of course, there's members of the church all over the world. Not that your services are necessarily for our world population, but anyway, it's good to know these resources. Any other suggestions that you would have specifically?
I want to put in a plug for my agency's National Disability Employment Awareness Month. We also have that, where we have posters and materials for any group that wants to get those. You can download them, or you can call, there's a number, or you can even order them online. And I really want to put that in, because October is considered National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and it's also Domestic Violence Awareness Month as well. So I definitely want to put a plug in for that, so you can share that with your faith-based congregations and the Mormon Mental Health Group. And these are great things to have. And we have a What Can You Do campaign as well. We have wonderful videos and even guides to use that are great little videos for any group that wants to use them.
Wonderful. Okay, so I know that I have limited time with you, so let me move our conversation to your role then on the Women's Trauma Federal Partners Committee.
Uh-huh.
Please explain to us what that is about and your role in that.
Well, I pulled out our little fact sheet that we produced several months ago, and that way I can keep myself focused. And I will also send you a link to that, or I can send a link to Tanya, and then she can send it to you, because she needs a copy of it as well, with the work she does with our Office of Public Affairs. So the Federal Partners Committee on Women and Trauma, it was initiated in April 2009 by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration Center for Mental Health Services. It started out as a work group within the Federal Partnership on Mental Health Transformation. And this came about from an executive order in 2002, was executive order 13263. We have a link to this in our fact sheet, which you can share with your constituency. And it was called the President's New Freedom Initiative Commission on Mental Health. And the committee's work is guided by the recognition that the impact on violence and trauma on women is a public health problem with profound consequences for many different agencies. So we started out as a work group, and within a year we were told we were a committee by one of my policy directors here at Office of Disability Employment Policy, who has since retired, but she says, oh, you're not a work group anymore, you're a committee. So we started calling ourselves a committee. So we develop a technical assistance agenda. We promote evidence-based public health practices. So our work group, as I said, we expanded membership. We coordinated two successful national roundtables. We released two reports that highlighted lessons learned and gained the attention of the White House. Again, our two reports are also linked in this fact sheet. So we started out with more than 25 representatives from six federal agencies, one of which was the Department of Labor, and several departments within these agencies. Now we have grown to we've got to update our fact sheet. My goodness, we have to update. We have more than 100 representatives from more than 33 different agencies and sub-agencies. And we even have the Peace Corps involved, and many, many multiplier effects have occurred from the Women in Trauma Committee. We've had cross-fertilization of the National Institute of Corrections, which is from Department of Justice, has worked with one of SAMHSA's funded projects called the National Center on Trauma-Informed Care, and they utilize the services of this technical assistance center to train more Bureau of Prisons staff on trauma-informed, what it means to be trauma-informed. And the Peace Corps changed their entire training. In fact, they were doing an updated training just last week to their medical advisors in the Peace Corps, and they changed their training to be trauma-informed. And it's just taken off. And we've done two webinars this year. We started webinars. We had more than 1,000 attendees, which is really great for a federal webinar. And we've done this with very little funding and support from some of our federal agencies. Even the roundtables, it would be something that cost $150,000 to do, you know, with a contract. We are saving the government lots of money because we're all together in this. And it's been a wonderful labor of love. And the members, we have some men as well as many women from all these different agencies across the board, and we keep seeking out other agencies that we need to have on this committee so we can have more collaboration and more sharing of information. So we are very proud of the work that we have done, and when I send you the fact sheet, you'll be able to see more information on that. So we do have to update it a little bit, and every 6 months we update the list of members. We have a link on the fact sheet to a link to the members, and it has their names and their agencies and their emails. So it's really interesting. We meet once a month. We have coordinating committees on different topics, Natasha, from first service providers to the peer voice to a workplace one. I work on the workplace one, and we're going to have a webinar in January on the workplace and trauma-informed workplaces. So military and veteran women, underserved populations, we have an outreach coordinating committee, and we want to rev up our human trafficking one. That's a very important one because there's also labor trafficking, and the Department of Labor is very interested in labor trafficking, which oftentimes becomes sex trafficking as well. It's a duo for the perpetrators. So very proud to be, I was the co-chair, and then a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago at this time, our chair retired, and she suggested to the members, and they all were unanimous, that I should be at the chair, and we co-chair this with the SAMHSA Center for Mental Health Services. My co-chair is Mary Blake, and we are the magic behind this. We just keep everything organized, and we try to keep everybody moving forward, and we're going to probably have a Roundtable 3. Working term, it's probably not going to be channeled at Roundtable 3. It's probably going to be called something different. But what we are about is we want to increase the visibility of having a trauma-informed national agenda. We would like to have a trauma-informed nation, and we do know that there are trauma-informed communities. There's some faith-based trauma-informed communities in New Jersey that I'm learning about. There's a trauma-informed communities in Tarpon Springs, Florida. There's some trauma-informed school systems in Northern California where they decrease the bullying and the absenteeism of the kids in these schools by embracing the whole idea about trauma-informed, if I can put it in a nutshell, is not to look at people that are perpetrators of terrible things, and they are perpetrators of terrible things. They are people that have had trauma in their lives, and it's all about hurt people, hurt people. Just remember, hurt people, hurt people. And you don't look at people and say, what's wrong with you? It's what happened to you. And the underlying baseline of what I've learned from all of these wonderful people on the Women in Trauma Committee, they have taught me so much. The underlying research of this is the Adverse Childhood Experience Study that was co-funded by the Centers for Disease Control and the Kaiser Permanente Foundation. It's the work of their medical doctors, Robert Anda and Vincent Felitti. You can just Google ACE study, and it's all about what you experienced as a child. And that's why having had a disability, either from birth or before you're 18, can have a real adverse impact on your lifelong experiences. It can give you mental health issues. It can give you other physical issues. And we do know that many people that have cognitive disabilities, what we call intellectual disabilities, many folks that have those disabilities, they know when people are treating them differently. They know. They're not completely out of the loop. They know when they're being treated like children, and they could be 45 years old, and they could have autism, or they could have an intellectual disability. They are adults, and you need to treat all people as adults and not as children. So this ACE study is the underlying baseline for a trauma-informed approach. It is unbelievable data. They've taught me a lot, and I learned a little bit about myself as a young person having experienced a traumatic experience when I'm a kid, and why I possibly have the personality traits I have. I think that could be part of it.
Right.
I'm very OCD. Because I think I have to control, because I wasn't in control. When you're a kid and you're 3 years old and you have no say in what surgeries you're going to have, and your parents decide for you. And I think that might be why I'm a little, have obsessive compulsive disorder, and I'm really strange about that.
Right.
People, and it can make people feel like, oh my gosh, this person is really out there and I can't work with her because she's too controlling and things of that sort. So that's possible. And I learned that from being a member of this committee, from different speakers. And I learned a lot too about the workplace and trauma, and using the resources we have with ODEP. The Job Accommodation Network has multiple, that's one of our technical assistance centers. Anyone can use the Job Accommodation Network. And remember, for your podcast listeners and viewers, the Job Accommodation Network helps both employees and employers know how to have even to do workplace accommodations for people with mental health issues. And that's why I learned a lot more.
So what, when you talk about trauma-informed, if we're going to make this applicable to, like, let's say a Mormon congregation, what would that look like? What would a trauma-informed congregation look like?
A trauma-informed group, they're working on it still, but SAMHSA has a trauma-informed guidance that they're working on. And just to be aware, and there's training that every congregation can get. The National Center on Trauma-Informed Care can offer training. A lot of the Office on Women's Health, which are members of the Women in Trauma, they can offer training. And this training can be free because they're federally funded projects. They're federal employees. And I suggest that we did a wonderful trauma-informed introductory training, and we have the PowerPoints in that, but it's best to do it with a live trainer, not just... But the PowerPoints can be a start, and it gives you all the ACE background. And I think just awareness of this is good. I think looking at some of the trauma-informed communities where you work with all the systems, law enforcement, your congregation, work with all your systems within the congregation, so that they all know how to work with people that are undergoing traumatic events. They could have domestic violence issues. They could be going through a divorce without any domestic violence issues. It's just getting a divorce is trauma. Moving is trauma. Getting a new job is everything is stressful. So work with all the systems and not just relegate that to one group, but you have to have all the systems coordinating together. For instance, as I was starting to say, a trauma-informed community has law enforcement, the school system, the health and human services system, even the workforce system, like an American Job Center and the workforce investment boards. All the systems need to work together. Even housing need to work together. solutions to where people need supports. They need work. Work is one of the best resiliency tools. A quality job is a really good way to help people bounce back from, you know, not being able to pay your bills, being unemployed for a long period of time. That's trauma. You don't know if you're going to have enough money to feed your family. You're going to lose your house. The American dream, losing your home, is a really traumatic event. All the systems have to work together. And so I would suggest looking at the ACE study, getting the data from that, sharing that information, and using some of the federally funded programs that can offer that trauma-informed basic training and then go on for people that are maybe be providing services, direct services to people to get more detailed and advanced training on trauma-informed approaches as well.
Well, and it sounds like all along you've said that there are even phone numbers that people can call on a lot of these websites that we'll be linking to, that if they want to help or a better understanding of what exactly resources are available to them, that there are those on your end that would be willing to help members of congregations with these types of efforts and projects.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, the federal government has many, many resources for many, many different types of topics, and this is one of them. And I think the information is out there, but it's sometimes hard to know who has it. And I can send you the link to our fact sheet. I sent you the link to our job accommodation network, which I've used a lot of their materials when I've done presentations on trauma-informed, about how to have a trauma-informed workplace, on things that an employer can do. Many things are of very low cost or no cost. You know, for instance, someone that can't work in a noisy environment because noise can trigger different things. And, you know, how to put that person in a noise-free environment or a white noise environment, different factors, and even how to train other staff. So there's so many things that can be done to assist people to providing services, as well as people that are not providing services, just to become a trauma-informed. What we want to have is a trauma-informed nation and model, and that's what one of the action items we're working on is even mapping. We want to do something where we map all the different federal agencies that we have on the Women in Trauma Committee. Many of them have contracts and grants in different parts of the country, working on violence against women projects, Office of Victims of Crime. SAMHSA has projects all over the country. There's all different types of things, and we want to look at where we have a lot of different contracts and grants that we're funding, as well as state organizations, as well as nonprofits. Where is there a nexus of a lot of groups that work across even state borders? For instance, Cincinnati is right across from Kentucky. Let's just use that for example. So there might be things in Ohio and things in Kentucky that are all working very similarly, but they don't talk to each other. And we would like to have more of these groups share and collaborate with each other with some communities of practices. And we all know that grants have a certain shelf life, contracts have a certain shelf life, but if we can increase the capacity to have more systems change, that's what we're for.
Wonderful. Is there anything in particular that you could share with us as far as statistics with women in violence?
I don't have them at my fingertips, but I do know that for women with disabilities, the violence against women with disabilities is much higher than the violence against women that do not have disabilities, mainly women with intellectual disabilities, and especially those that are in institutions. And oftentimes it's their caregivers that are doing that, and sometimes they even withhold their Social Security checks because they go to the bank and cash them for them. And it's very, very serious. And I can send you those. Tanis Doe, I think she passed away a few years ago, but she's a Canadian researcher on that, T-A-N-I-S, and her last name is Doe. She has a lot of information on that. Margaret Nosek, N-O-S-E-K, has published quite a bit on violence against women with disabilities. It's very sad. Now, the Women's Bureau has some working women with disabilities fact sheets that are going to be coming out sometime soon. They're vetting them and finishing them up. So they have some fact sheets, and they're going to be talking about women with disabilities and violence. I asked that they put that in their information. And they worked with ODEP on that. It was a joint thing. They funded it, but they worked with us. We were a mutual partner with their contractor on that work. So there'll be a lot of more information on working women with disabilities coming out soon. But I don't know when. That's the typical government answer, sometime soon, because we don't know how long it takes to get things through clearance processes.
Right. No, I understand.
But they are
that.
coming, we can assure you of that.
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, you know, as you're talking and I'm thinking kind of through some of the things that we're currently dealing with, just kind of more within a Mormon construct. I mean, I'm thinking of all of our LGBT youth and adults that are in our congregations and some of the trauma that goes along with having to disclose sexual orientation to more religiously traditional family systems, or even church systems. And we're kind of all over the spectrum, you know, in this. There's horror stories I hear every day, and then there's just like very loving responses every day that I hear about. But still through the, you know, over the pulpit, we're still very much espousing non-marital equality rights, you know, from leaders in our church. And so I know that that has an impact on our LGBT members. And I'm also thinking about domestic violence is, I think, a huge taboo issue in our church. We do kind of have a patriarchal system still, in the sense of the man is called to preside over his home. And oftentimes, I think in these religious families, you know, there's a lot of importance on the appearance of having, you know, things put together. I think this is probably one of the stigmas with mental health anyway, in general, even outside of violence, is not
Right.
being vulnerable enough to share that, hey, we're all struggling in one way or another, pretty significantly, usually. And so these are just kind of some of the things that are coming up for me as you're speaking and thinking about, you know, issues that I come across on a pretty regular basis anyway.
Yeah, and I'm so glad, Natasha, that you mentioned the LGBT community, because many of the LGBT organizations have bonded with the disability community because it's a very similar type of stigma.
Right.
Especially in the workplace.
Right. Yeah, and then not feeling welcomed in certain either family systems or congregations, or keeping it secret because they don't want others to know. It's just all can really be part of this overall issue. And you've given us just kind of a long list of resources that I'll try to make sure and link to all of these different things that you're referring us to. And because I share a similar goal of trauma-informed congregations and helping those within my faith community to live healthier and more productive lives through all these, you know, interesting things that we're learning and research that we have available to us and resources. And I think there's a lot of suffering, unfortunately, that is, I guess, in some ways unnecessary. You know, if people had the resources or the knowledge or the understanding, there might not be as much suffering as there is.
Yeah, that's why we really have to. I mean, it's so critical, and I think one of the big issues of the 21st century is gender inequality. Besides the environment, but gender inequality is just really bad still, and not where we want it to be in the United States. But you look at different developing countries, and it's pretty bad out there.
Well, and that's
Yeah.
definitely an issue as well for us. I mean, you probably have heard recently about, we just had a recent excommunication in our community of a woman who was, you know, advocating for gender equality within the administrative offices of our church and things of that nature. So it's definitely an issue within Mormonism as well.
Wow, that's interesting. I did not know about that.
Yeah, so that's.
I belong to the Roman Catholic Church, and
Yeah, you guys have similar issues, right?
so maybe things will change with our new pope. Who knows? Well, priests were able to marry up until about the 4th century.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they were. Thank you so much, Natasha.
Thank you, Carol, so much for being on, and I really appreciate your time and your knowledge and your expertise, and we'll definitely be in touch.
I will send you links, I guess, to Tanya with all the things I suggested. And even in that first report of the Women and Trauma Committee, we do have references to violence against women with disabilities. The researchers that I mentioned had references to those as well.
Wonderful.
But they're getting a little dated, but it's very, very serious.
And relevant. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. You have a nice afternoon. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening. Oh.
chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Unknown ways before me roll. Hiding rock and treacherous shore. Chart and compass came from me, Jesus, Savior, pilot me.
As a mother stills her child,
boisterous way,
boisterous way,
obey thy will,
obey thy will.
When thou say, when at last I near the shore and the fearful breakers roar, may I hear thee say to me, fear not, I twixt me and the peaceful rest,
the peaceful rest.
Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear thee say to me, fear not.